Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and we are considering the upsides and downsides of the idea of sanctuary today. Later this hour, the critical social challenge for community leaders, educators, to create credible sanctuaries from the stresses of poverty. Designing a safe place may be the most important weapon in fighting poverty. We'll learn about that later this hour. Meanwhile, denying extremists a safe place may be the best way to close off the pipelines of recruitment and funding for terrorist organizations. This week, President Obama declared that with the proper resolve, the international community has more than sufficient means to deny sanctuary to extremists everywhere on the planet.
Resolutions alone will not be enough. Promises on paper cannot keep us safe. Lofty rhetoric and good intentions will not stop a single terrorist attack. The words spoken here today must be matched and translated into action, into deeds, concrete action within nations and between them, not just in the days ahead, but for years to come.
President Obama speaking at the United Nations. One potentially concrete action came from more than 100 Muslim clerics from around the world who have issued a letter in classical Arabic addressed to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the purported leader of the Islamic State headquartered in Raqqa, Syria. The so-called Islamic State is not a state and does not represent anything that is Islamic, said one of the leaders, Usama Jamal, Secretary General of the U.S. Council of Muslim Organizations. None of their actions pass any litmus test to show that they have a sound understanding of Islamic ideas. There is no sanction in Islam for ISIS, these clerics have declared. At the United Nations, President Obama's first concrete action to use global cooperation against ISIS and other extremist groups is to appeal to the Security Council to give the call to isolate terrorists the force of international law. In a rare personal appearance at the Security Council for a U.S. president, President Obama's argument won the day. The Security Council passed a resolution 15-0, noting how in the past some notable Security Council resolutions have been flagrantly ignored by nations and parties singled out for sanctions. We welcome Alexander Evans, the coordinator of the United Nations Security Council Sanctions Monitoring Team. He's also called the expert at the UN Security Council on Al-Qaeda. Alexander Evans, thanks for being here.
It's good to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about enforcement and what it is that you do particularly. Does that resolution have some force of law as a result of the 15-0 vote? And are you mobilized in some way to take action?
It does indeed. So this resolution, along with a series of Security Council resolutions back to 1999, set out under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter an obligation on all member states of the United Nations to enforce sanctions against Al-Qaeda and associates.
Now, in the case of making it illegal to join such an organization, how would you determine that? How would you detect that that is in fact the case? How would you create a list of people who are to be targeted or arrested or I don't know what?
So let's separate out three things. On the one hand, you've got a list of groups linked to Al-Qaeda that are formally identified and put on a United Nations Security Council sanctions list. At a second level, you have a range of individuals, key individuals, who are also on that list associated with these groups. But that, of course, means that for enforcement, you're still talking about member states. And that's the third dimension, and it's a crucial dimension, that as we heard earlier, it's not so much the rhetoric or the language around a Security Council resolution, it's the obligation that that places on member states, and then crucially, it's how member states actually implement that on the ground.
And since you've been in business for a while dealing with Al-Qaeda, right, al-Baghdadi, I'm presuming, because of his association with Al-Qaeda, would have been a persona non grata, subject to arrest in virtually any member country already before this resolution passed?
Well, the subject to arrest piece depends on national arrest warrants. The crucial thing is Baghdadi is also on the sanctions list. Now, that means you can't give him money. It means you can't let him cross an international border. You can't help him in any way in activity that relates to terrorism. Now, that's all good and well, but you know, you're often talking about individuals who may not have a bank account, who may not take a plane from one country to another. So the aim of the targeted sanctions from the United Nations side are also to really focus on some of the key facilitators and intermediaries, the people who are recruiting foreign terrorist fighters in Europe, are the people who are providing finance to groups. And so, if you like, it's the accountants and facilitators and helpers of these groups that are as important to target as the leaders of the groups themselves.
Now, does the definition of recruitment require falling under some law within a nation where a person might be found to be recruited, say Pakistan or Afghanistan or even one of the Middle Eastern countries?
So what the Security Council isn't trying to do is completely replace the role of member states.
Right.
You know, in reality, member states are at the heart of implementing counterterrorism in their countries. But I think one of the new agendas is trying to make sure that you have more multilateral coordination and action to help support those efforts by states. So, you know, if an arrest is going to take place or an action to freeze assets or deal with a particular problem, it's much more likely to happen by a nation state's authorities. But the challenge now is you're talking about perhaps some 15,000 foreign terrorist fighters from over 80 countries congregating around al-Qaeda-associated groups, in particular in Syria and Iraq. Now, that basically is a challenge that demands multilateral coordination, because you may be talking about somebody who comes from one country in North Africa, travels through Europe, and then heads to one of these groups. So you need a lot of countries to be cooperating in terms of sharing data, sharing information, and collectively taking action to make sure that that people are stopped.
Interesting. One last thing, and this may be, you know, out of your sphere of expertise here, but, you know, ISIS controls territory on the ground. It's not a state. It's a part of a state, Syria. It's a part of a state, Iraq. Is there any way for the United Nations to extend its enforcement into territory that might be recognized nationally, but is in a sense in a kind of a gray area because it's controlled by this rogue nation that calls itself a caliphate that's been declared completely illegitimate by Muslim clerics, that sort of thing?
I think the key to enforcement there is trying to make sure it's squeezing the money in particular, and trying to make sure that funds and assets that they've already seized are controlled where possible, but crucially trying to stop some of the further income flows that might feed into the group. And that's particularly from commodity smuggling in the area.
Including oil sales, those kinds of things.
Absolutely. So the reality is that the more you can squeeze the money, the less danger we have from what is this toxic mix today, an unprecedented volume and range of foreign terrorist fighters, the continuing toxic nature of al-Qaeda-related ideology and inspiration to generate attacks, and potentially the money to support it. And that's a pretty nasty mix, and that's why I think there's been such a concerted international effort to try and tackle this.
Interesting discussion. Alexander Evans is the coordinator of the United Nations Security Council Analytics Support and Sanctions Monitoring Team. Quite a mouthful there. Alexander Evans, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
About the situation in Iraq, there's a sense of heartbreaking deja vu for officials and former officials in Washington, D.C., who were key players or in some cases architects of the 2003 Iraq invasion and the Bush administration's war on terror. Those officials constitute a gallery of quiet voices, some supportive, some critical of what the Obama administration is doing right now. Todd Zwillick has been soliciting some comments from this gallery. Todd, who have you been speaking to?
Well, John, good to talk to you. I sat down yesterday with Richard Armitage, former Deputy Secretary of State under Colin Powell in the Bush administration. People will remember him. He's a big linebacker guy with glasses, kind of a bald fella. People will remember him as one of the architects of Colin Powell's famously botched weapons of mass destruction speech in front of the Security Council. They'll also remember him as the man who blew the cover of CIA operative Valerie Plame. Well, Richard Armitage, John, has been in the diplomacy and intelligence game for a long time, and I asked him how he views the current crisis in confronting ISIS.
First of all, let's not hyperventilate. This is not a crisis. 24-hour news cycle, 24/7 news cycle makes things a crisis. Fact of the matter is it's a problem, and it's a problem to either be resolved, mitigated, or managed. We ought to be able to do that. But when a president of the United States sets as our goal, we're going to destroy ISIS, that's a bar so high that I don't know if we can reach it. After all, we haven't destroyed al-Qaeda yet. So I think we need collectively to take a deep breath.
I remember the reports about Armitage handing out huge stacks of cash in Afghanistan to warlords as a way of dealing with al-Qaeda, winning the hearts and minds back in the early part of the 2000s.
And stay tuned, because we might get to some of that later in this very interview, John. I'm glad you brought that up. But the real point that Armitage and a lot of other experts are making, that airstrikes make the news, airstrikes are spectacular, and airstrikes can kill some leaders. But then your enemy melts into the cities, they melt into the town, and it's about confronting them on the ground. Listen.
The Kurds, and the Peshmerga particularly, are the boots in Kurdistan. And they will fight for that. They'll be fine. The questions about the Iraqi army, go back to what I said about Syrian moderates. We can equip them, we can train them on tactics, but if we can't inculcate them, the willingness to die for their country, as the other guy apparently is willing to die for his beliefs, then we will ultimately fail.
So the Kurds have a real mission here. The Iraqi army, not so much. I'm wondering if they need a little help from, special ops, the CIA and Pentagon, Navy SEALs, that sort of thing.
Just the kind of thing you want to ask Richard Armitage about, a guy who led covert strike teams all the way back in Vietnam and had a long covert career before his diplomatic career. Well, John, I asked him that very thing. How do you get people who aren't necessarily aligned with our interests to fight for us, to fight with us, when they have other priorities? And I asked him about a couple of things that maybe the U.S. could do secretly.
I famously made a mistake in my career by inadvertently naming a CIA operative. I don't think I'll take the occasion of an open mic to talk about what should be done covertly. I think I'll decline the offer to embarrass myself further.
One of the things that made the Sunni Awakening a success is that we made it worth their while and paid them a great deal of money to fight on our side. We need to be doing that with the Free Syrians, I suppose.
To those who are amenable to it, if that will switch a tribal loyalty, that's fine. It worked to some extent in Iraq, and it worked for a while.
So speaking of nations that benefited from the situation in 2003, Iran was said to have really been the coming out real positively after the U.S. invasion of Iraq. I'm wondering if they're a possible mediating force here, and what does Armitage think about the Obama administration's positive comments about Iran at the United Nations?
Richard Armitage said that Iran needs to make a choice about how much influence they want to have in Baghdad with Shiites there versus how much they want to defeat ISIS. He said ultimately that's their choice. Listen.
Look, until Iran reaches a point of view on what they are willing to do in Iraq and what they're willing not to do, then it'll be difficult for us ever to coordinate with them. Talking with Iran is nothing new. And we talked during my time, I personally talked with the present foreign minister, Zarif. We dealt with him on counterterrorism after 9/11 quite a bit. A lot of meetings in Geneva and other places, so there's nothing unusual in that. Actual coordination right now is a bridge too far, and I agree with Secretary Kerry on that. I don't think there's some secret deal being cooked, at least not at present.
And John Armitage said something else that Secretary John Kerry's been saying. It's important for the United States to keep any deals, any secret deals, if there ever were one, separate from what's going on with nuclear talks with Iran. Don't let Iran make lowering sanctions a condition of helping with ISIS. Keep those two tracks separate. Iran wants to merge them right now.
So how long of a game does Armitage think this whole fight with ISIS, this renewed war on terror, is going to be?
Well, I asked him if we weren't likely now to be facing, 5 or 7 years of Yemen or Pakistan-like activity. We bomb ISIS members when they pop up. We drone them where we can. And on the ground, they undertake kind of a low to mid-level insurgency-style war.
That's not a totally unrealistic at all assumption, I think. But remember one thing. That's not all bad. There's still no existential threat to the United States. And that's the key to prevent any of these countries or organizations from becoming an existential threat. The problem with terrorism, and my problem with some of the approach that we've had to it, is although terrorists can't make us change our way of life, our reaction to terrorism can bring about changes to the American way of life that are actually quite detrimental. We have to really be smart and guard against it.
Well, John, you hear from Richard Armitage what you might consider a lot of lessons learned from 2001 and from 2003, the invasion of Iraq, as we look forward to 2014 and a new war in Iraq and Syria.
Some soft-spoken, humble wisdom from Richard Armitage, someone who had a reputation for not being quite so humble when he was with the Bush administration. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
Pleasure, John.
So former Bush administration official Richard Armitage learning lessons. We encourage you to share your lessons learned. Be a part of our listener response network. You get one text a day by signing up. We ask you a question featured on the next day's program. Your voice becomes part of the on-air conversation. All you do is text the word START to 69866. START to 69866. Messaging and data rates may apply, of course. You can reply STOP to opt out. Shot there, courtesy of our director, Jay Cowett. So is it the best of times or is it the worst of times for Apple computer these days? Best of times? Well, record sales for the iPhone 6. The new little dandies are completely sold out, more than 10 million sold in the first weekend. But worst of times? Well, that would be the software glitches discovered when consumers downloaded the new iOS 8 mobile operating system. Also, an annoying mechanical flexibility, let us call it, discovered by consumers in the new iPhone 6 Plus, a flexibility observed on YouTube now more than 20.5 million times. Actually, oops, no, 20.7 million times, looking right now. Bridget Carey, senior editor at CNET.com, host of the daily news show CNET Update. Happy to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So this flexibility, of course, is literally bending the iPhone 6 Plus.
Right. So Apple always makes their iPhones thinner and lighter.
Thinner.
And with this larger one, maybe it's too thin and too light because it's made of aluminum. And unlike a plastic phone, it's not going to bounce back. If it's in your front pocket, as what some people have found, and they have these tight jeans and they sit for a while, then they get up and they realize their phone has a slight warp in it.
The quality control people over there at Apple are probably getting a talking to as of today. Now, you look at that. You're a CNET, you know, dweeb here. Like, let's just be real. You look at that video of the phone bending. Does that say to you, defect, I don't want one, you know, consumers beware? Is that a five-alarm fire for CNET?
Well, there's the very popular video where a guy is forcibly doing it with his hands.
Right,
so
right.
Obviously he's trying to, you know, see if it bends. But when people are putting it in their pockets and it's happening, yeah, I kind of look at that and go, wow, why would you want a phone that's even more breakable? We're always worried about having a phone that we can accidentally smash. Now it's about being fragile, perhaps. So here's a situation where Apple is – its confidence that consumers have in it might be tarnished a bit. Not only do you have this phone, but now you have a problem with the operating system ruining some new iPhone 6s where if they downloaded the iOS 8 update that happened the other day, well, they lost the phone part of
they
their
lost
phone.
The phone. Yeah, they couldn't
it,
use the phone.
It turned into an iPod, basically.
One little fact check thing. If you bend your phone, does it break? I mean, is it actually non-functional or is it just bent?
It looks like
not so.
It's just slightly warped. And you do have to, though, not play around with this. It's not a joke when you're really trying to bend a phone. If you mess with the battery, there are warnings that it could explode with that battery. You don't want to do that, basically. So,
well, that's such a CNET thing to say. Don't do it. Don't do it. It'll blow up.
Phone.
Yes, right. Now, do other phones bend? I mean, did you guys try other phones? I mean, it's possible. I never heard of this happening, but it's possible that other thin phones do the same thing.
There are videos where people are trying to bend other phones as well. And there's another brand of phone that's made with aluminum, HTC. But no, it doesn't bend with the same amount of force. So it'll be interesting if Apple on the next try maybe changes something. You know, there is actually a part of the new iPhone that could be vulnerable, and it's a weak spot. It's the Apple logo itself. It's a cutout. So when you have an aluminum backing and you have a cutout of the Apple, it seems that's the sweet spot where it is more susceptible to being bent.
So design is the brand at Apple. Do you think this harms that brand because this seems like kind of a shoddy design?
All right, so you're chipping away at the confidence. You
right.
have you have a design where you don't even know why it's bending, but all over your social media feed, you're seeing that, you know, do I trust the next Apple phone? You know, but we still will line up. I think in time people will forget, just like how they forgot about AntennaGate and they forgot about the Apple Maps problems.
Did. All right, before we go, with all that, do you still want one?
Maybe I won't go for that extra large one.
Richard Carey, senior editor at CNET, host of the daily news show CNET Update. Thanks so much on that Apple update, Bridget.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to see you in the actual real flesh here as opposed to just the cutout there on the screen.
We'll be right back.
timeless holiday question. What can you do with a 7-pound brisket? What can you do with a 7-pound brisket? What can you do with a 7-pound brisket early on a Rosh Hashanah morning? Well, toss it in the pot and boil it for about 7 hours. That's right, the traditional holiday chow for the Jewish holidays, brisket boiled all day or stuffed into a pressure cooker, that can reduce the time. Or maybe just get out the old jackhammer to tenderize that sucker. Dan Pashman joins us now. Dan is the host of WNYC's Sporkful Food Podcast, author of the forthcoming book, Eat More Better. So, Dan, you have the traditional jackhammer brisket going for the family today?
You know, I've been cutting back lately. It's really rough on the stomach, I got to say.
So are you a traditional Rosh Hashanah guy, or are you going for, like, the hip update of Rosh Hashanah?
I probably lean more towards the traditional. I mean, I kind of feel like these holidays are days when you eat foods like a food like brisket.
Yeah.
Brisket takes a really long time to cook. It's not the kind of thing you throw together for dinner Tuesday night when you get home from work. Why not celebrate the traditional on those holidays? Because you're only going to have that food a couple times a year. That being said, I personally am interested in the idea of leaving brisket behind just a little bit because I'm not the biggest fan of Jewish-style brisket. Whenever I eat Jewish-style brisket, I just keep thinking about the fact that I wish that it was a Texas-smoked brisket. And so I'm endorsing the growing movement to replace brisket with short ribs.
Ah, you know, it takes about as long to cook, and it's a much more tender cut of meat.
That's right. And I think – I mean, I know that on Rosh Hashanah you're supposed to sort of steer the meal towards sweet flavors because you want people to have a sweet New Year. But I'm more of a savory guy, and I think that savory with the short rib, that's going to go so nicely with your apples and honey. It's a perfect combination.
Apples and honey. Now, where does that come from? Is that Eastern European, like your wife's family?
No, I think it goes back farther than that. I mean, this time of year is traditionally an apple time. You know, as I said, sweetness is a recurring theme in the Rosh Hashanah traditional meal. Have a sweet New Year. Pomegranates are also very common. Figs. And I mean, you know, honey obviously has been in existence for millennia. In fact, the ancient Egyptians enjoyed themselves a nice glass of honey wine.
What is the variety of apple that works best for Rosh Hashanah?
Look, if you're going to drizzle honey on it, you don't need to worry too much about finding the sweetest variety of apple, certainly. In fact, I think one that's less sweet is probably going to work nicely and complement your honey quite nicely. But, you know, there's so many different apple varieties to choose from, John, and there's a great – there's a lot of marketing effort that goes into naming a new apple varietal. Like Red Delicious, you know, everyone knows Red Delicious because of the name, but actually it's not that great of an apple. You know, Honeycrisp has probably sold 100 bazillion bushels of apples just based on the strength of its name alone.
And I love Macoons, and, you know, nobody likes those because the name is so – you know, it's so boring. It's just, what does that mean?
A very marketable apple name will sell itself to you. It will tell you a little bit about what it is. Speaking of which, if you're interested, John, I have a little game we could play together.
Let's do it.
And this is a game for people of all faiths. Listeners can feel free to play along at home. This game is called Apple Variety or New England Town.
Ah.
I'm gonna say something, and you tell me if it's an apple or a town.
Okay, let's go.
All right, first one up, Ashmead's Kernel.
Ashmead's Kernel. You know, I know New England pretty well. I'm going to say apple on that one.
You're right.
Okay.
Next one, Cumberland.
Well, it's probably both, but I'll say New England town there.
You're right. That is a town. That's not an apple. Leominster.
All right. Now I'm really getting into this here. Leominster. I'm going to say apple, Dan.
I'm sorry to say that is actually a town. It's Leominster, L-E-O-M-I-N.
Oh,
so,
there
but you put
you
the
go.
New England accent on it, it sounds like a fruit. Okay, Adams Pearman.
Adams Pearman. I'll go with New England town on that.
That is an apple.
I'm ruining my day here.
Final one, Baldwin.
Well, that's a New England town.
That is both.
Yeah.
That was a trick question. But you were half right, I suppose.
Half right. Yeah, that's the half right host. The half right host on this Rosh Hashanah. Dan, have a great holiday. Thanks so much for those suggestions.
Thank you, John. Take care.
Dan Pashman is the host of WNYC's Sporkful Food Podcast and author of the forthcoming book, Eat More Better. Consider now the trade-offs of supporting a family in poverty. Food or gas this month. Heat or rent this month. school, or childcare this week. Imagine parents saddled with such stark choices. Now consider if it is a child.
When I was in the 10th grade for the second time, my mom started asking me if I could stay home from school to watch the kids. If I said no, most of the money she would make would go to a babysitter. I failed every class that year.
Housekeeping and childcare more urgent than an education for young high school student Jairo Gomez. Bitter memories that he discusses here with his mother.
Do you remember last year when I had to stay home to babysit? How do you think it affected my grades?
Yo creo que te afectó mucho, Jairo.
Academically, it affected you a lot. I did wrong in making you stay, but I didn't have an option. At the time, I sacrificed you. It was either good grades for you and you'd go to school, or we were going to suffer and lack necessities.
Growing up revealed to Jairo that what has always been normal for him was, in fact, being immersed in a daily trauma, the trauma of poverty, invisible to Jairo until, as part of a reporting project, he took an objective look at his family's situation.
I used to think of my family as middle class. We'd go out to eat a lot, and I could ask for clothes sometimes. But after my parents split up, my mom had four more kids, and that all stopped.
Do you think we're poor?
The truth is, I haven't looked it up in the dictionary, the word poor.
Para mí,
to me, poor is when you don't have enough for soup or a roll of toilet paper.
Un rollo de papel.
What is poor? It's a question no child should have to answer. Jairo discovered that his family's income was well below the poverty line. He discovered that as part of a reporting project for WNYC's Radio Rookies. While he was protected from the poverty numbers as a child, he was not protected from the consequences in absenteeism and health risks. Daniel Cardinale is president of Communities in Schools, an organization that works to fight poverty by making safe places, sanctuaries for kids. It's a new idea, and it sounds hard, but Cardinale says it begins with simple mentoring, an adult making a safe place in the midst of hard times.
When you think about kids who are living in extremely difficult situations that poverty imposes on young people, one of the most important things is that there's an adult who is able to kind of manage not just their academic needs, but their whole story, what's going on in their family, what's going on in their neighborhood. Does this kid have an adult who thinks only about them and not managing the other effects of poverty that many of these kids' parents are trying to deal with? And so once that adult is in their lives and they can build a trusting relationship, kids open up. They begin to believe that there are possibilities. And when you provide sets of resources that enable them to really focus in on learning, their horizons open up and they begin to really see a possibility of going on to post-secondary attainment and really being able to get a job that will break the cycle of poverty and enable them to be self-sufficient as well as support their family and their kids.
And as crucial as the parents are in situations like this, what you write about and what your experience tells is that when the kids see how stressed the parents are in the poverty situation, it limits their ability to make the home a sanctuary like this classroom that you're describing can possibly become with the right adult.
That's exactly it, John. You know, I was listening to some of the work you all do with the Radio Rookies program, and I was listening to a story by Jairo Gomez, which is very much like what a Communities and Schools kid experiences. A high school student who's really put between very untenable choices, between focusing in on school and managing a very difficult home life where there are 11 people living in a one-bedroom apartment. And the pressure, the real pressure he feels to take care of his younger siblings because his parents are working, and also work where he's actually contributing to the family wage. And the fact that kids in poverty are often put in these very untenable choices, when we know one of the most important things for young people to be able to do when they are in school is give their all, be kind of open not just to mastering these skills, but beginning to incorporate them and imagine what their future can look like.
What kind of an adult, what kind of mentor, what kind of teacher, what kind of school administrator does it take to create that kind of a sanctuary when the stresses are so oppressive on the outside?
You know, we have the privilege of working in about 2,200 public schools across the United States and charter schools. And we work with about 1.3 million of the nation's poorest kids. And what we know is that the teachers and the principals and often the superintendents running those large systems are very much dedicated. They are passionate about educating children. And most of them have been trained academically to drive pedagogical and instructional leadership in the building at the principal level, or teachers with new strategies on differentiated learning and student-centric learning strategies. What they aren't trained to do is to use the community as a resource. So by having a site coordinator that CIS trains and certifies nationally as a partner, what we see is superintendents and then principals and teachers who understand that these are resources to them, they create a much more holistic environment where the social-emotional, the non-academic needs are being met and aligned with the drive towards driving academic outcomes. For poor kids, this is a particularly transformative environment, and schools become sanctuaries where they're getting hot meals. They're getting often access to food and clothing and shelter through the school, mental health services, outreach to their parents. And many of our site coordinators are bilingual, and they can reach out into the community and make school a place where parents can participate and become part of the education of their children in ways that they may not have experienced when they were growing up as young people.
And you've seen this where the school, far from being something that you want to skip or be absent from, that families and students particularly are drawn to the school suddenly.
Absolutely. I remember I was recently in March out at one of our schools in Los Angeles, Manual Arts. I remember being toured around the school by a young man who was a freshman. And he told me very explicitly that he comes to the school every morning at 6:30. His mother drops him off on her way to work. She's working a couple of jobs. And because of that school having a holistic place where he is both academically successful, but he's in lots of extracurricular activities, a communities and schools site coordinator is building a relationship with him and opening up horizons and imagining what he can do during the summer in terms of job shadowing. And he gets connected to a tutor and some mentors. So the school is a place he very much looks forward to. And he said to me that he really enjoys coming to school so much so that he doesn't really care for the food because he loves his mom's cooking, that he will actually go hungry until about 6:30 when she can pick him up on the way home from work because he loves being at school so much. He could go home and get a meal, but he prefers to forego the nutrition to be able to be in this environment that is just so kind of fulfilling and nourishing to him.
Daniel Cardinale, president of Communities in Schools, thanks so much.
Great being with you, John.
And that's our show for today. Movies tomorrow, remember, with the Movie Date podcast team, Kristen Meinzer and Rafer Guzman. We'll also take a stab at digging up and looking at a few things we might have missed this week on the program. Dig up a story for us. What did we miss? Scandals? Big ideas? UFO conspiracies? Hey, just give us a call after your abduction, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. If you want to catch up on or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.